Hi, I'm Joe.
And I'm Dave.
And we're the hosts of the Chasing Tomorrow podcast, where we bring you stories that delve into the science and spirit behind intriguing people doing extraordinary things.
Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. This week is episode 39. To say that I'm stoked this week is an understatement. I've got on the line right now with me one of my running idols. In 2018, me and the rest of the ultra running community all over the world were absolutely mesmerized when we were watching Johann Steen and Courtney DeWalter duking it out down in Big's backyard, where Johann ended up taking the win at 68 hours running around Laz's backyard. 68 hours. That's 283 miles. So Johann and Courtney, you know, just last year ended up running the exact same 68 laps, and they both hold the course record down there. And I can't wait to talk to him about 2021 and if he's going to be down at Biggs, and is Courtney going, and I'm going to go for sure. And I just can't wait to talk to him about that. Johann is also the world IAU 24-hour bronze medalist back in 2017. He ended up running a Swedish national record of 266.515 kilometers in 24 hours. That's absolutely brilliant. Want to talk to him about Volstead? Want to talk to him about Barclays? This guy is an ultra running legend, and I am so excited to announce that we have Johann Steen on the call. Welcome to Chasing Tomorrow podcast, Johann.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be on. Happy that you will have me as a guest. Doesn't sound like me when you describe me like that.
You seem so humble, right? Yeah, absolutely. This is a monster resume.
Yeah, maybe.
Very impressive. Johann, I always get this sort of the pleasure of starting the first question. And, you know, often I think when we hear that kind of accomplishment over time, it's like sort of people see the end of this story, but don't fully understand how the story was written up to that point. And, you know, I do think that many of us start not knowing what's possible with ourselves, our capability, what we could go after in life. So, you know, you're from Stockholm, Sweden, or at least that's where you are now. So maybe a little bit of the Johann story, where you were a good runner in high school, you know, did you find this later in life? And then sort of like, how do you end up, you know, running for 68 hours, which you love? But yeah, just tell us the beginning story, if you would.
Yeah, I will try. I was not an athlete growing up. I was playing some football, as we do here in Sweden. And I quit doing more or less every sport seriously when I was before high school, I should say. But then I found the hobby of rock climbing, and I did that for a while. And I have always been enjoying being out in nature and being in the woods, but not regularly. But I read a book. I started working. I had some sort of a career. I worked a lot. And when in the mid 30s, I read the Born to Run book by Chris McDougall. And just that, I don't know, it took me 2 days to read it. I was really fascinated about it. And I bought everything in there. I had no critical thought at all. I was just, okay, that's why we're put on the earth, to be running long distances. I need to try that. And I started doing that. And it was winter in Sweden, so I couldn't really adapt into this barefoot thing. But I pretended that I was running barefoot with my shoes on, and I was just longing for all the snow to melt so I can try it for real. I was running several times a week, and after a few months I was running every day, and in 2011 I was starting running every day back and forth to work, and adding on really fast the volume. And of course, I was really curious about where my end would be, or where my limits would be. And so that was driving me towards trying ultra running, was the fact that I was curious about where will I find my limits? Will it be in my mental ability or my physical ability, or combination of them, I don't know. So I was signing up for several races. And since I was doing that, I was also trying to find races in the faraway locations where I would get an adventure as a part of that race. Mm-hmm. And I was just really hooked on the sport from the beginning. And it was never a competitive thing. I didn't want to be good at it. I just wanted to see how far I could stretch my own abilities.
And so it sounds like curiosity, Johan, is the piece there. Have you always been were you a curious boy when you were a kid, a curious student when you were in school?
I think I'm stubborn. I want to understand things. I need, mm-hmm. I stick with something until I get bored of it and then I quit. But up until that point, I do it really, really much. And I think it's always been like that. And some things I don't get bored of, so I just stick to them. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but I like to understand how things work. And of course, I'm really curious about to understand how my mental abilities work and what makes me strong and what makes me weak and everything in between. What are the triggers to perform well, and what do you need to comprehend just to do well at long distance running, and or to when you do something for a really long time, what are the key factors to be successful at that? I mean, that's mm-hmm. something that intrigues me.
What have you figured out so far?
When it comes to the ultra running, it's so fascinating that you think that you will find a limit, because I was working several years to find my own limits. And then I realized that there are no. I mean, mm-hmm. when it comes to the ultra running, it's the sleep deprivation thing that everyone will have to deal with at the end, because the body can take so much and you can train your mental ability to so far, but sooner or later you need to let your hormones or chemicals or whatever it is in your brain to rest. And you have to do that and be good at that as well. And mm-hmm. so you can constantly push the limit, of course, on what you're able to do. And I think that's the human drive in everything that humans do. I mean, you have to push Absolutely. The limit. You have to get even further. And that's why we are here now in so many numbers all over the planet and just trying new things. From the beginning, we had a few in the pack that was the most curious, I guess. They were running over the open plains up on the hill at the horizon just to see what was on the other side. Was it a better place to live? Was it more food on the other side of the hill? I don't know, but I mean, I think we're genetically programmed to just see what's on the other side and push the limits over time.
And Johan, do you think that you're maybe, you know, genetically, you know, predisposed to doing something like this? You know, what I've noticed is, as characters like yourself and the Courtney DeWalters of the world and the Pete Kostelniks, you know, there's a durability piece. There are people that will do something and then there'll be a slow decline and they'll fall apart a lot quicker than other people. And then you look at take Courtney DeWalter, and, you know, she crumbles, but she crumbles well later than most. Do you feel like you're durable?
I physically, no, I don't think so. I think of course there is some differences between us even there, but that's when it comes to crumbling slowly, I like that expression. I think it's, you have to just be, you have to live with what's hurtful at the time. And, mm-hmm. and you need to understand that will, maybe it won't get worse. Maybe it's not, it's definitely not fatal. It's just something that you have to live with at this specific period of time. And you know it will go away eventually. So it's not very scary if you think about it like something that comes and goes. And I mean, maybe you have to live with it throughout the next of the race, if we're talking about running races. But I mean, then you know after that, it will go away. It will not be a permanent damage. Almost nothing will be a permanent damage. So I think it's, maybe you're durable in your mental ability to just mm-hmm. to stay with the pain, the physical pain. And I mean, the physical pain is, that's almost the only question you get when you talk to non-runners about long distance running, is how doesn't it hurt in your legs or your feet or whatever? Don't you break down and stuff like that? And I mean, the thing that makes you a winner or a loser in this competition is, of course, your mental ability. For how long can you do this and stay sharp and continue though your thoughts constantly goes towards finding reasons not to continue. I mean, that's all the thoughts will, and I guess those thoughts will happen to the beginner runner and up to the world elite, is that we can, when it comes to the long distance running, you can slow down a little bit. I mean, it happens to me all the time when I do the 24-hour racing, because it's a timed race. So you don't have a specific length that you need to do to finish. That means that the faster you run, the longer you have to the finish line. And that's a track for your brain to comprehend, especially when you're tired. So if you slow down, you get the feeling that it's a shorter, you get the feeling that it will be a shorter distance to the finish line, but you can persuade yourself that this is a good enough of effort. This is good enough. You've done well. So just take relaxed and take it to the finish. But at that point, it's of course interesting to find people that can push themselves, even though they don't have to, and push them to a limit, even though that they have maybe 6 or maybe 10 hours left in the race, and they find themselves on the brink of what they're able to do even there, and they do that all the time, and they are so effective on balancing on the line between doing it perfectly on their ability, on the brink of their ability, because if they do it little too much, they will collapse, or they will crash and burn.
Right.
And if they do it a little bit too easy, then it won't be a top performance. And I guess the best in the world, they are able to balance there on the brink of not falling down the abyss and not falling behind and stay safe.
Yeah. So let's talk specifically about that, Johan. Like, so, okay, you finished third place in the world 24-hour championships. You're an exceptional backyard runner, 24-hour runner, full state, a lot of really, really long events. 6 hours left to go at the World 24-Hour Championships. And, of course, I've got another question for you later on about, that everybody was running blind. You didn't know if you were in first place or fifth place or in 20th place. But 6 hours in, or 6 hours left to go, you've been running for 18 hours. You've been running for roughly 200 kilometers. That's a big boy number. And, it is enough. You've run enough. But you have 6 hours left to go. What's going on in Johan's mind? What are some of those key little tricks that all of us other runners that would love to run like you, that could end up taking a little nugget of like little mantras, do you focus on that tree and just run to the tree, or do you break it down per hour? Do you look at the person in front of you and catch them? Like what are some of the tricks that you do?
Dave, I don't know. If I try to remember in 2017, the 18th hour, I was really happy. As you mentioned, I was really happy with my performance up until that point. And if you can break 200 kilometers at that, around that time, you know that you've done well, especially when you have my ability of 24-hour running. And I knew that I can break my personal record, but still, it's 6 hours left, that 6 hours where things can go wrong and you can just crash and burn. So it's a little bit intimidating, but also that's so much less feeling than to the feeling of being in a positive spiral, because you've done well so far, and I had kept to my schedule really well. I had kept a really steady pace. I had the same pace for the entire race, and so I felt secure and confident, and I had an excellent support team with me. They are fantastic in every aspect, I had promised my dedicated support person Ulf. I promised him that I would do my best, and that's a lot to promise to someone if you're gonna keep it anyway. So I promised him that I would do my best. I wouldn't stay down or lay down or take speed off. I would just do my best up until the end. And so the support crew asked me around hour 18 if I wanted something, because I was just eating when I was feeling hungry, or feeling that I, maybe not hungry, but when I felt that I needed energy. And I only drank when I was thirsty. I didn't have a schedule for that. And I always do. I always try to do it like that. And so they asked me, do you want anything, Johan? Everything looks super. Do you want anything? And I was thinking, something should happen now. I mean, it's really boring to run around a park for 18 hours. And
it
I mean,
sure is.
Yeah, nothing happens. So I was thinking, yeah, maybe something should happen. So I asked for, we call it a salt grog. It's just, I don't know the English word, but you put so much salt into water, so much salt into water. So it's it's a chemical word, but it's the water cannot adopt any more salt anymore. So it's extremely salty water, and you can take a sip of that and you will get a salt shock, and your brain will feel that, okay, we put some salt in the body. We're good. We're safe.
Wow.
So they gave me a flask of that, and I took two sips of it, and it was too much, and I didn't need it. And what my body reacted instantly that I was feeling sick, and I felt extremely sick. So I couldn't continue running. So I had to walk for a lap. And that, you know, I'm coming into this up until this point, extremely happy with my performance. And I knew that I could do something really good with this. I only had 6 hours to go, and I felt good. I took these sips and I felt like shit. I was under the ice, and I was scared that I would have to walk it in for 6 hours and I would get a mediocre result or a bad result. You know? So sad, scared, and had one walk loop. Do you remember, Dave, how long the loop was? Approximately 2Ks, I think.
About 2 kilometers, yeah.
Yeah. And during that time, someone gave me a cup of Coke, and I drank that, and I felt a little bit, the sweetness of that made me feel a little bit better. And then after that, I started jogging, and maybe in another loop or another lap, I felt good again, and that was away. And then I decided, no more doing things just because you feel bored. Just stick to what you need, and everything. Everything from then on in went great. It was extremely frustrating not to see your result and see where your other competitors were in comparison to you, but especially your own result. You don't know how far you reached at every lap. So I just kept to my pace and kept to my strategy with eating and drinking. And When day came, still nothing happened with the timing equipment. The support crew, any support crew didn't get any result lists or standings. So we were all running in the blind, more or less. And of course, you can get information like, right now it looks like you're the fastest person on the track, but I mean, right now it looks like it's not something that you would like to hear in a world championship. You want the exact numbers and the exact facts.
Well, and Johan, so let's put this into perspective for the listeners. So, you know, you and I know what we're talking about, but in 2017 at the World 24-Hour Championships in Ireland, the timing system went down. And, you know, we rely upon that so heavily, in any race, of course, but then especially at the World Championships when everybody is running a timed race and you want to know that you are, you know, 1.5 laps behind fourth place person, and then third place person is here. And as a runners, we're being relayed all the information back and forth. And so it gives you either confidence or makes you afraid and scared that person's coming behind you, or you are this far away from a podium spot or whatever that is. And so that's what we're talking about is the time system at the World Championships, where you end up getting a bronze medal. You're running blind.
Yeah, and I mean, so were all of my fellow running mates or competitors in that race, and it was more frustrating to some of us than to others, of course, because that's also what type of mental person are you? What type of thoughts do you need or strategy do you need for doing your best performances? Some people rely so much about that information that constantly mm-hmm. get fed with the right statistics. And some people perhaps are more comfortable with just running blind. But no, it was really frustrating. And especially the last couple of hours when you were chasing placements. I mean, horrible. Mm-hmm. And also, as I said before, for me, the thoughts are always there that you can slow down just a little bit. You've done so well. You can slow down a little bit. My own voices keeps talking to me. Right. Just stay safe. Don't push the limit. If you push the limit, maybe you get injured. Maybe you don't. Maybe won't be able to continue. Maybe you have to stop. But if you stay on the safe side, far to the safe side, you know at least that you will get some more kilometers in. So you have to silence those voices and just keep pushing for the edge.
So it's interesting, Johan, this sort of the intersection of the physical and the mental and knowing which balances out more. You know, when I ran in 2017, I ran a marathon on 6 continents in 6 days. And when I started, I wrote this note to myself. I talk to Dave about it all the time. The lows will be the highs, you know, and I went looking for how bad could I possibly feel, you know, I'm not going to sleep much for a week, fly around the world, try and run every day. And when I finished, I'm like, well, I never found that low, you know, and of course there were moments that were there, but I think I had started to find out like some moment that probably happened, but the context was set in my mental state. Physically was the same, right? You know, it was going to be physical body is going to do what it does. I don't think we can really influence that. I mean, we eat and that kind of stuff influences, but it reacts to the system, but that mental context. And so what's interesting, you've done a few races where I think the mental might have a bigger impact than the physical. So let's compare Big's Backyard to Barclays, and where Big's physically, for most of us who are ultra runners, we can get around that course in under an hour, the 4.16 miles, right? And you know, there's a point where maybe you turn your ankle and that will take that out of the case. So much of it's going to be a little more mental than physical. Then you get to Barclays, which is a completely different race, and over whatever is 30 some odd years, is 15 or so finishers. And it's been defined as a physically grueling race, you know, in the, of course, the orienteering part is hard, but I think if you've been there before, you have a pretty good sense that that's not the thing in the way, right? It's hiking up these huge mountains through the day and the night and so on. So it's still a mental element, but maybe more physical. So maybe just compare a little bit, if you could, you know, is that a good distinction and does that really play out that way?
Yeah, I think you're onto something. I mean, it's Barclay for me is that's at this point, if you could call it a career, but as I've done so many fun races and so many excellent adventures, and it's nagging me that I haven't finished the Barclay. I mean, I want to finish the Barclay. Yeah. I mean, it annoys me. No, but seriously, it's actually the only race I'm interested in completing.
So you've done it 4 times?
Yeah, maybe 4. I think so, yeah.
And then are you going back this year?
I failed 4 times at the race. I mean, it's ridiculous. I should have learned something, but now it's hard. And as you say, it's very physical race. Someone without the absolute best physical ability won't be able to finish Barclay. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. That's how it is. It's just nothing that you need to have every piece of the puzzle in place. You need the mental aspect because you will not be able to do that course when you're tired, when you're wet, cold, sleep deprivated. I mean, and when your voices have started talking to you about quitting or whatever. I mean, you need to be fantastically well prepared mentally to be.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you need to be on your absolute, I mean, you need to be an elite physical runner or otherwise it won't be possible. So Barclay is the pinnacle for me in adventure racing or running racing. Yeah.
I think in racing in general, I'm trying to get Dave to get out there one of these days, but just for the context of some of our listeners who don't know, it sounds doable, right? For ultra runners, you know, sort of like run 20 miles a day, you know, or 20 miles in 12 hours, like you have 60 hours to do 100 to 120 miles. That would be easy for most people.
Yeah, the numbers, they look easy.
Right.
But then you have to look at the elevation gain. And then you have to look into the aspect on, the orienteering, it's not really orienteering, but you have to navigate. You have to be really comfortable in navigating, and you need to be able to navigate in darkness and in mist and in snow and in hail and in fog and whatever. So I think you need to be, you need to love adventure and, because after a couple of days or not even that long, it won't be so fun anymore if it's around freezing and raining and everything is wet and you are constantly chased by those 12 hours to complete the loop. Because of course 12 hours to complete 30 miles or whatever, 30 plus miles, almost any ultra runner can do that. But then you have to do it again, and you have to do it again, and you will not have any long rest in between those loops. Right. I mean, it's a few minutes, you restack or repack your backpack and grab something to eat, and then you're on it again. And it's a fantastic race. When it comes to mental aspect, I was thinking about that. If we jump back to the 2017 World Championships, I started early because it's also very, and it's an endurance race also for the crowds, right? For the ones that are there cheering on, the runners. I mean, boring to stay in a park for 24 hours, just see people jogging really slowly, more and more crumbled to the ground throughout the hours past. And so I started early, just cheering back on to the audience or whatever, the other support teams and to people coming to the park to watch this spectacle. And when the morning of the finishing day, when the sun came up, they had somehow adopted me, which gave me, of course, it gave me a lot of energy because they shared and did the wave and just screamed happy things to me when I passed them. So the last, 2-3 hours were amazing. I was just lifted by all those spectators that was there cheering me on. And that is something that I learned from, maybe you don't have to learn that, but someone told me in the beginning of my, when I started running races, I think it was in 2012, it's a British guy, fantastic guy called Robbie Britton. He runs for the GB 24-hour team, or used to do anyway. He said, "Johan, please make sure to always give away positive energy to all your fellow runners and to all the people that are standing around and watching you run, because you will have it back so many times."
Yes.
So I always try to do that because it will be more fun for you and it will be more fun for everyone there watching as well.
Yeah, and Johan, just a little story about Robbie. Like Robbie and I are good friends, and Joe, we got to get Robbie on this podcast. Let's send him a text right after, because I was at the World 2015 in Torino. You were there too, weren't you?
Yeah.
And Robbie got, was it third place there or second place?
Third. He was podium anyway. He was
he was the loudest guy out there, and he was smacking guys in the rear end and cheering everybody on. And you're thinking, like, who is this guy? But he is so full of. He in fact even ended up in the stadium. It's a 2-kilometer loop course. You know, I was running with him for about 2 hours nearing the end, and he ended up even stopping. And he gave my wife a kiss on the cheek and he said, "Listen here, sweetheart, you're attractive. Your husband's unattractive. I think you could do far better." And he kept running. And I was thinking, like, who the hell is this guy? And, you know, you just take that energy and you think, you know, there's no doubt that this guy is a winner in life. And he could figure this out during a 24-hour, boring timed event, he's winning in life. He's remarkable.
Yeah. Well, there is this sort of phenomenon that says if you smile at someone, they have to smile back. They just can't not. Right. And a friend of mine in Aussie told me, when he runs and races, always smile. And so I was running in the Boston Marathon and hitting that Heartbreak Hill area, these hills towards the end of the marathon. And if you go towards the sides and run up the hill and smile, like, people just freak out in positive ways. And you're like, just helps get you to the top because they're excited because you're smiling. You're one of the few, everyone else looks miserable. And so you really do get a lot back with that. It is a fascinating lesson to learn in this sport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we all know it's a mental game. I mean, that's where you get all the fuel for doing this for so many hours. And if you can help that a little bit, of course you should do that. And if you smile, you will just stimulate your brain that you're happy. I mean, the brain is stupid that way, because as long as you just stretch your smiling muscles, the brain will think, okay, this can't be so bad. It should be okay right now. And then you can do, you mentioned the marathon. I did a marathon I don't remember now. It was the year after the Boston bombings anyway. So I was in Boston doing the marathon there, and it was the crowds were huge. I don't know. It was fantastic. Everyone has just come to show their sympathy for the race and
yes,
for the runners. And I decided that maybe I need some extra boost here. So my wife bought me this really, really nice sunglasses shaped as this, like parody sunglasses, looking like stars, glittery stars, 70 rock stars sunglasses, yellow with sparkles on them. And then I had I don't know what it's called, this sweatband you have that tennis players had in the 80s. I had one of those in the Swedish colors, looking like Björn Borg. And I had my long hair out and I was running like that. And I think I had a Swedish flag as a cape on my running singlet. So I looked really spectacular. All throughout the course, all the crowds were shouting like, "You go, rock star. Yeah, you're the rock hero," all the way.
Yes.
For 26 miles. I mean, that was an extra boost. I guess that was probably, that was at least 5 minutes on that time, I guess.
Yeah. How about that? When you run through Wellesley and all the girls from the school come out and scream and yell for you. I mean, so
yeah, I heard before that that's the most critical part of that course, because if you start listening to that, everyone increased their speed just to show how manly they are, and so many great runners has failed there. So I decided to think about that and take it really slow and just enjoy the screams.
That's it. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. But it was interesting to see, because the pack that I was running with, they all sped up at that hill. They all sped up. I was the only one that kept the pace. And after a while, after a few kilometers, I was passing them because they were tired.
There you go. See, good strategy all the time.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Are you heading back to Barclays this year? What's
I was hoping to do that. I'm really looking forward to it. I missed it last year, as you know, for the corona, and now this year as well. The travel restrictions were too harsh, so I couldn't find a way. At least not a logical way to do it. So I decided to go. And hopefully it will be there even in 2022. For me to fail at. I need that to come and fail at. No, I definitely, I really would like to give that a real good shot.
Absolutely. Yeah, and Johan, we were talking to Katie Wright a few weeks ago, and then Will Hayward, who got second at Biggs last year in 2019. Mm-hmm. And, and myself, I would love to nothing more than for the travel restrictions to be lifted. In Canada right now, I don't think it could happen, but I think that our numbers are looking better and better, and travel restrictions are lifting all over the world, it seems, in the next many months. And so let's start talking about Biggs 2021. I would like nothing more than, you look at that start list, it's ridiculous. It's a stacked list. And I would love nothing more than to toe the line with you. And I think Courtney's planning on being there, and everyone is lining up to go to Biggs. Is that on the schedule for you?
Yeah, it should be, or it is the main event for me this year, 2021. I'm really hoping to come over there and towing the line together with you and all the other fantastic runners, because that might be a party.
Oh, no question.
Yeah, and also it would be really, really interesting to see what Carl can do with Courtney and me and you and all the others on the original course. I wrote him and congratulated him on the world record here, and he said, "Yeah, thank you so much, but you know, we need to do it on the original course. Can't we meet up there?" And I said, "Of course, it's a date. So hopefully we can be there all of us in the fall and see how far we can push the original course."
Yeah, and we were talking about that, Johan, offline. About how, people are fascinated by Biggs. And I'm fascinated. I think that Johan, you're fascinated. Joe, I know you're fascinated. And the, 4.17 mile loop every hour on the hour until you can't or won't. I think I was telling you that, I really do believe that if you get enough oddballs, if you get enough, people who love, finding either what's longer the rope or the bottom of the well, and get them all together. If you end up having 6 or 8 or 10 runners go beyond 60 hours, even 70 hours, I think that you can end up having a 100 hour Biggs this next year. Do you think that that's at all even reasonable?
I don't know. I both want to say yes, and I want to say no. I don't know, actually, but I think I said a couple of years ago, at least 80, 85 hours. I mean, that's going to happen. I thought that was going to happen the year after me and Courtney, but 100, it's of course it's going to happen. 100 is going to happen, but it needs to be happening with people that are very comfortable with the sleep deprivation thing and have the tactics laid down to how to handle that. Mm.
Yeah, so
that's the key here. I mean, this is just going to be. It's going to be a sleep deprivation contest. Mm-hmm.
So Johan, I'll kind of explain my tactics. Last year, in that I really do think that speed is rewarded on a course like this. Especially during the night, when the sun's down and you're running on the road, you can open up a little bit. You don't have to worry about foot placement. You can just zone out and run out and run back. And I know a couple of my loops were 35, 37 minutes. That's a bit quick, but even coming in at 40 minutes, it allows you 20 minutes to be off your feet. And as long as you have a routine where I would come back and sit in my chair and lean back, and my coach would put earphones in my ears, and it was the white noise and blank out my, and he would say nighty night, and I always knew that he would wake me up right before the second whistle, I always thought I'm not going to fall asleep, but I ended up falling asleep almost every hour. And I really do think that when it comes to going long, having some sleep earlier on, especially over the evening, you're getting 3 minutes here or 5 minutes there, I think it really will help with running beyond 60, 70, 80. Would you agree, or do you have any sleep strategies?
I totally agree. And I think as in 2018, I came in late to the race. I had travel trouble. So I was really tired when I started the race. So I could start sleeping more or less from the first loop, just going onwards. I slept not all the loops, but more or less from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I think, of course, as anything else that you do, you get used to it, or you get the hang of it. So if you learn to fall fast asleep and you're comfortable with that, and that you have a good support that will wake you up and take care of you, because, I mean, you have to do all the other things as well. Take care of any chafing, take care of energy, take care of liquids, take care of everything like that. And I mean, in the day loop, you don't have so many minutes to spare, right? It's little bit tricky there, and especially when you get tired on the second or the third day. I mean, so you have a few minutes to eat, drink, and then you need maybe 2-3 minutes to sleep. At night, I totally agree with you. Speed up a little bit, not only to get the sleep in, but also to change the different type of muscle groups that you use while running. So you can refresh, I mean, the day muscles or day ligaments a little bit. Just, yeah. I mean, variation here is good for the body, yeah, and also for the mind, because even though that the night loop is extremely boring, I mean, it's an out and back on asphalt, still is something different. And it's just, you count down the 12 hours and then you're back at the day loop, which is my favorite. And there you have all the trees and the rocks and the cliffs and the jumping and the turning. And I mean, that's funny, at least for a few loops, and then you start counting them down as well. But I don't know, but when it comes to sleeping tactics, I think it's crucial to be be secure in that you can fall asleep, and that those few minutes will actually help you, because they will. And then at night, of course, have a few extra minutes, because that will be crucial if you're going to go 100. I don't know, Dave, go 100. I don't know what it will take, but it will definitely take good sleep tactics. Definitely.
Yeah, and I think it'll, like, back to even what you were saying about, you know, the positive nature, you know, smiling, laughing, telling jokes. You know, my thought is you know, myself, you know, Courtney, you know, guys like Guillaume, you know, being out there and taking turns telling jokes. I think that it's going to take a team approach in order to crank out though, and then you not let somebody else quit. You know, you drag thing, them right? along for a loop.
You need someone else who's going to be equally committed, sleeping as well and prepared as well. It's probably one of the most unique races in that way, because if you're trying not just to win but to actually move the record forward, you need other people who are similarly committed to that level of execution. And so, you know, you could end up having, as we've seen, one of these races, a backyard format, could have a 30-hour finish or a 70-hour finish. It sort of all depends not on the guy, the person who can go the farthest, it's on that next person.
I mean, I think as we all know, Lass has put a lot of thought and really crisp thoughts into this. And
yes,
and also when it comes to just giving the credit to the assist, the person that gives the assist to the winner. I mean, that's crucial, of course. Otherwise, we won't see these spectacular records.
Yeah.
And I think, Dave, if we're going to push it to 100, I totally agree with you that it needs to be a pack of runners that want to push each other up until there. But you know, let's say that we are above 80, a few of them are above 80, and all of a sudden there are only three, then some of them will start thinking about, maybe I have a chance at this, maybe I might be the last one standing. And then it's not so interesting anymore to drag the pack with you. Then the mental warfare starts.
Yeah, and then, you know, you look at me, I look at you, and I don't show any weakness, and you're not showing any weakness, but we're both really hurting.
Yeah, of
course. You know, it's a funny dynamic, really, don't you think?
Oh, sorry, say again. Ask me again, I missed that question.
Oh yeah, no, it's just that I'm showing weakness, I'm not showing any weakness, you're not showing any weakness, and it's a really dynamic situation. It's a really different race, because there is no finish line. The finish line is when the other person drops out.
Exactly. But if we can decide, which I think a lot of runners will be a part of, if this starts in 2021, the bigs, is that we're going to push as many runners as possible above 60, maybe above 70, as you mentioned. And there it will be a team effort, but when it comes down to a few runners at the end, I think that team effort is out the window, because now you see that you might be the one that be the last one standing, and then you stop doing all the things necessary to keep the pack alive, which is keeping together, talking all the time, keeping all the brains fresh from the sleep deprivation, because if you just have another person next to you touching you sometimes, talking to you, you will keep more fresh. I mean, you will have other hormones working than if you were on your own in the dark.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, my best guess is if we come up over 70, 80, then you will, and there's only a few runners, let's say three, four runners left. I think one or a few or a couple will try to break free and just leave the others by themselves. But it's also interesting because if it's four left or even three, it's tough to break away to be by yourself, because then you're eating away faster from the sleep deprivation because you have no people talking to or interact with. So
it's pretty lonely out there.
and the loneliness is what comes and gets you at the end. I mean, when I was doing the race in, I think it was 2014 with Jeremy Evil, we didn't know each other and it was only him and me left in the race on the second night. And he did really slow loops, like 58 minutes. And I was at night, maybe at 40, 42, something like that. So I decided to walk with him because he walked most of the loop. And I said, okay, this is more fun. We stick together and we get to know each other and we have a good time. And that was, yeah, we both agreed, this is a great idea. So we did that for like 6-7 hours and then we had really fun and we didn't race anymore because we were out just walking during the night having a conversation. And then it came to me that we cannot continue doing this because we will just keep on going and going because we keep each other awake. So I broke off and did my race and I said that it's just I will do it the way I had intended and you do it the way you intended and we'll see what happens. And then we did the night and then I realized, I don't know if you heard the story, but I had to go home. I had a plane to catch. I just did one day loop and then I wanted to let him win, but he refused to win like that. So he quit as well. So no one won that year. But that was so obvious to me that as long as you just have some friend in the night talking to, you won't get sleep deprived. But after that race, he told me that when I have left him and he came to the turnaround mat, the timing mat out on the road where you change direction and run back to the finish, when he reached it at one point, he didn't realize how to climb over it. It was like a mountain. So I had to lay down on all four and crawl over it. That's how sleep deprived he was. But he never told me during the race. That is something he told me a long time later.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's funny.
You have Johan, do you have any specific training that you do to get ready for a bigs versus any other race you might be in?
A couple of times before a backyard, I have done a backyard, one night backyard with a friend, just getting into the rhythm.
Yeah.
So we run this 6.7 kilometer loop. And we stay in, we've done it, I think, three times. And then we have the support area in his garage. So we sit there and have a snack and a drink, have a talk, and then we do the loop 12, 14 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So otherwise I do a lot of my training, or I don't call it training, but I run back and forth to work. I commute by foot and that's how I get all my running done.
Mm-hmm.
And
how far is it from you?
It's approximately 10k, so I get 20k a day just by commuting, and then when I train for something I run one more time a day. So I normally I don't do long runs. I do several short runs instead, which I think is suitable for the backyard format. I don't know, but also the thing that I've been training like that for many years, short runs, but often. And it's also, I think even here, it's a mental thing. I'm pretty comfortable with running a loop, resting a little bit, running another loop, resting a little bit. So it feels like I should be good at that. That's how I've been training all the time.
Yeah. And, you know, something you were saying earlier, Johan, about, you know, battling the voices in your head about, you know, the enough, you know, this is enough. And, you know, myself, I, you know, that's my biggest demon as well too. I have a hard time kind of quieting those, you know, and the further you run or the faster you're running or when you're climbing a hill, it's, you know, the voices get louder and things. And so I think there is a special, you know, skill that you end up learning through, you know, Barkley or backyard or 24 hour or, you know, 200 mile races or whatever that is, where you can end up, you know, it's not that those messages of enough ever go away. It's just that they get quieter or you find different ways to distract yourself and go, oh yeah, it, you know, it's not enough, or maybe it might be enough, but I still have something left in the tank. And I think this is why guys like Lazarus Lake are so beautiful, because they create these meaningful experiences, these opportunities for you to go there. And it's not necessarily putting your entire limit out. It's that there's always a little bit left. And he always asks you the question, is there any more? And yeah, there probably is. Sure. And so is this why you're so attracted to his events? Is because, you know, maybe your fascination with the term enough, and his ability to make you dig deep to maybe discover what's enough. Is that why you're so attracted to his events?
Might be. I think maybe that's one thing. Maybe the first thing was that it's really low key. When I came to the first Biggs backyard, that was because they persuaded me to come there because I had done the last annual Vault State the same summer. And why I did the last annual Vault State was that I read about it and it seemed like a really crazy race where you're hoboing around rural Tennessee for 10 days without any support. And it felt like a great adventure for me to do during my summer vacation. So, and it's really low. It used to be, maybe I should point that out. It used to be really low key races. It was hard to fill up these races. No one wanted to do them. The same goes for Barkley, but that was even further. But I mean, now, I don't know, is it you will have backyard races in 50 different countries this year? I mean, it's huge. And in 2014, there was no one knew about it. It was nothing. So it is evolved really fast. But I think the last races, they have done so much for me when it comes to pushing my own boundaries and to finding my own limits and to meet new people, getting so many new friends that I love. And I'm so happy that I decided to go to the first race for me that Lass made was the last annual Vault State. And I guess he sent me an email saying, oh, you're coming all the way from Sweden, you're crazy. Yeah, I better pick you up at Tennessee in Tennessee airport. And I said, okay, how common is it that the race director pick you up at the airport?
Yeah,
but then you have to help me out with the preparations for the race. And I was so happy. I mean, that sounds like a dream. I mean,
yeah.
So that was the first encounter with Lass. And I mean, I just love the guy.
Oh yeah, an incredible man.
Yeah.
You know, we had Lass on early on and we called him the diabolical hillbilly from Tennessee. You know, one of the smartest guys in the world who might have figured out how to tap into something that sort of is buried somewhere in our psyche about this idea of, you know, that suffering, you know, studied in the Buddha world, the Buddhism world, but really this idea of, you know, self-determination and feeling power and control over ourselves in a world that has lots of out of control circumstances to it. And I think the more that it gets complicated, the more we want this sort of very primitive feeling of, you know, power over self, because if you have power over self, then nothing really bothers you. You know, it makes life much, much easier. And it's hard when you don't have any challenge to that in a world of, you know, whether it's Netflix and gaming or sitting on the couch or just working, we don't do enough anymore to stimulate that. When, you know, years ago, there were no such things needed for adventure racing because life was an adventure. Mm-hmm. You know, you had the challenge if you were a coal miner or if you're a farmer, or you were just pushed to the limit. So you didn't need a roller coaster.
to get excited. You had it in a daily way. And I think now we're finding more interest in the difficulty, whether it's an obstacle course race or an ultra marathon, or these at the outer limits are still us as humans. I think you said this when you read about Born to Run. It just sort of, it triggers that need to know more and to help that self-determination. And so it's been fun having the conversations over our podcast, because we're finding more and more that consistency. I don't think everyone really fully understands the why they're doing it, but they know what's happening when they do it, you know? Any thoughts on that, Johan?
Yeah, I agree with you so much. I mean, you would never do something that is strainful if you have a strainful life, right? Mm. I mean, you need to have everything in place to be able to find a hobby that is ultra running. Otherwise, you won't do it. So it's only the privileged that will start doing this, because the otherwise are fighting for real. This is a pretend fight that we are doing, and we need to remember that this is just for fun. But also with that said, I mean, we need to link our mind to the rest of ourselves, which is also including our body, and that's a way. This is a way of doing that. I mean, we need to feel the hardship, not only the hardship of not feeling that you lack the ability to please all around you or whatever, the mental ability to perform well at work. I mean, also the ability to push your body to the limit and use your body and feel comfortable with in your body and what the body can do. I think we miss that, because we don't have to. If we don't want to, we don't have to. Everything is just an arm length away. We can open the refrigerator and we will have food there.
Yeah.
We don't even have to do that anymore. We can just tap into the phone and someone will bring you food to the door. So I think this is, I'm so extremely happy that I found this hobby of long distance running. And I've said so many times to myself and to others that I need to be careful so I don't lose it. I want to do it until I die. And for a few years, I think I overdid it a little bit. I raced too much. I trained too hard. I felt it was becoming a burden, a job. Yeah. It was becoming a second job. And then it's not fun anymore. And then I don't have to do it, because I already have a job where I work a lot. So, I mean, the running is my hobby. The running is my ventilation. That's where I get some fresh thoughts in and where I can move my body and just clean my mind.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Johan, like I always like to think, the chairs that, the three of us are all sitting on right now, they're comfortable, right? Yeah. They're good enough. I mean, in the last hour, you haven't been thinking, hey, this is a comfortable chair. but yet, for you and I and Joe went out and ran 200 miles. And then the very first thing that we do is sit in this exact chair. This chair is now, the most comfortable thing we've ever sat on in our lives. And you can't really truly feel true comfort until you felt true discomfort. And yeah, we live a very, very comfortable existence on this planet. And so we now need to go and find discomfort to really, truly feel human. I really do believe that. So here we are, Johan. This is an incredible conversation. I love this. I love the I'm going to share this as well, too, on the Biggs Backyard Facebook group, where we have thousands and thousands of people that are obsessed with, and for good reason, for Biggs racing, because I think that this is going to allude to what's going to happen, all the throwdowns that are going to take place in 2021 down in Tennessee, if God forbidding, or God willing, that we can go there. But really, what's next for you? I've got a good idea, but what's Johan Steen doing, chasing tomorrow? What's next for you?
Right now I work a lot. I think it came from the pandemic. I mean, no travel, no adventures, no real traveling vacation with family. So it's been a lot of work the last year. Continues to be a lot of work, and that's fun, because if you do something a lot and you and you get good at it and you have good co-workers, then it's fun. So That's fun, but also longing for the big races and for the big adventures. And my main target for this year is to get to Tennessee and to Biggs in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that, and that it will be a real nice competition. And after that, I'm hoping that I will have a spot in the Barclay in 2022, so I can fail again. I mean, no, I won't fail.
You're not going to fail.
I will fail. But it's fantastic that when it comes to last races, I always feel ashamed when I'm not performing well, both for him and for all the other fellow runners. I feel, because if you take up a spot at his races, you have to earn it. I mean, you have to lay your everything there, because it's so many people that would like your spot. Mm-hmm. So you have to really, really do your best.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Count on you doing that for sure. Johan, I think you you tapped in for us today. You know, we say the science and spirit behind intriguing people doing extraordinary things, and you fit the category very well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It was really a pleasure talking to you. Really interesting.
Yeah, thanks and, we'll see you in the fall. We're gonna make sure we have lots of vaccines done here. We're on a good path, you and I, right now in the U.S. So we should be in good shape very soon.
Very good. Looking forward to see you guys in a forest somewhere doing many, many loops.
All right.
See you in October, Johan.
Thanks, Johan.
Have a great day.
Well, Dave, that was an amazing discussion. I know I'm not supposed to have favorites, but Johan was amazing. He really has done a lot of thinking about our podcast theme. You know, the science and spirit behind intriguing people doing extraordinary things. And I love his perspectives and understanding of how the mind-body connection comes into play in ultra running. It was truly one of the best I've ever heard. And it does feel like we're setting up for an amazing Biggs backyard in the fall. I think that could indeed be the highlight of the year in ultra running. Well, there you have it. That's a wrap for this week. As always, a shout out to our sponsor, Performance Tea. You can find them on www.performancetea.com, and they've given us a discount code for any of our listeners to get 20% off their purchase. Just use Chasing20 at checkout. And we'd greatly appreciate it if you could follow us on Instagram and give us a review on Apple Podcasts. That would just be awesome. And as always, a huge thanks to our listeners for coming with us on this journey and chasing tomorrow with us. Thanks.